Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 29, Episode 20. Coming up on the show, we've got the radio signals from Bigfoot, the Eon of Horus, and the calling of the Lord of Toads. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
If the last plus show is anything to go by, is the Lord of Toads, Crowley, Alistair Crowley.
Yes, how did you know?
How did I know that? I have no idea.
Now, on the Last Plus show on Tuesday, we covered a great article by Andrew Kim Arnett over at the latest issue of New Dawn, 198. And it was on Aleister Crowley and UFOs, and it's back to this old idea that Crowley's tinkerings in the early 1900s led to some kind of portal opening and the UFOs flying in some form or some force coming in and changing the fate of the world. This is connected to Jack Parsons, of course, who was a member of Crowley's magical order.
But it all kind of boiled down to the idea, essentially, that we're dealing with demonic entities, though.
Well, that was kind of the crux of what was tied into Arnett's article. He discovered that if you look at the Betty and Barney Hill abduction, it is in a location. They said that a craft came down and then they had missing time and then they were 35 miles up the road from where they started. Arnett pointed out in this article that where the hills ended up was precisely where Crowley was living, I think 40 years earlier. And doing these strange rituals with a toad.
Yeah. And it just happens to be a coincidence that you get these, you know, one of the most famous ufological experiences that's ever occurred. And it happens to be in a location where Crowley's been dabbling with these dark arts.
And then we followed the work of Robert Anton Wilson, who started just on a kind of satirical basis, researching the Illuminati. And he wanted to write a satirical kind of lampooning novel about Illuminati conspiracies. But as he kept researching, he kept on finding these synchronicities. It's almost as if the synchronicities started to intrude on his life, as if some intelligence, some force was leading him in some direction. And ultimately, as we explained, this led to Sirius, the star system Sirius, and in a bizarre way, back to Aleister Crowley. So I'm going to continue that thread on this show and look at this fantastic work from Paul Weston, which I did mention on the last show, Aleister Crowley and the Eon of Horus. And we're going to go into how Crowley's life changed, how this force came into his life. And essentially, Weston makes this argument that the nature behind this force that led to Crowley's writings and what he was doing went on to shape the 20th century.
Yes, it did.
Like, it was like a revolutionary intelligent force that changed the world.
Well, and it continues.
Not in a good way.
Not in a good way. No, but it seems like, because I was thinking about it after that show, and it feels like it's actually not just, you know, kind of just subtly changed the world. It's almost like it spurred off the direction of humanity in this weird kind of way that it's like it's irreversible now. And like, we're talking about the 20th century, but now the 21st century, the way that now the media is starting to go, well, look, there's tic-tac UFOs, there's recent sightings of triangular-shaped craft that the government's going, we don't know what they are. It seems like things are rapidly accelerating at the moment.
And where we're going to end up on this kind of mad rambling journey is back to the star system Sirius, and we end up at the Montauk conspiracy.
No.
Yeah, the Montauk conspiracy.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to getting into that in just a moment. For our Plus members later on in the show, we're talking about, you know, cyclic events. Of course, you would recall, you know, some of my favorite work has been done by the researcher Stan Gordon. He did that fantastic research starting in the 1960s in Pennsylvania. He highlighted in his book, Silent Invasion, it detailed this strange activity of Bigfoots being associated with balls of light, UFOs, you know, just this crossover.
Missing peanut butter.
You're missing peanut butter, exactly. Trash cans being turned over, that kind of stuff that was going on. But all of it kind of reached its peak between 1972, 1974, beginning of 1974, it stopped. Really, it's known as a 1973 flap, if we're going to make it very reductive. But there were obviously, you know, featherings of it throughout the time. But the thing is that things kind of quietened down. And Stan Gordon, in his research, who he still persists as a researcher today, he's fantastic. But things kind of died down. I mean, still a casual level of stuff coming through, but the reality is it's firing all back up again, and it started just during the pandemic. 2020, all of a sudden, there seems to be a correlation with, you know, maybe the stress that was happening in the world, the disjointedness of everything that was going on, the fear.
Stan's been cataloging this stuff on his site
For decades.
For a long time.
Yeah, for a long time. So I'm going to go into some of his new reports that are coming up. There's apparently in 2023, obviously in 2022 as well, there's been a plethora of Bigfoot activity occurring in Pennsylvania once again.
UFOs?
UFOs.
Has he got a tech upgrade?
Balls of light. Well, there is, and this does lead, you talk about, you know, leading back to things. This leads back to Linda Moulton Howe and some contact that she got with someone describing some Bigfoot recordings, and it links in with, let's just say, Bigfoot technology.
This is going to be a real, is it real show? Is it real?
Is it real indeed? Well, I mean, apparently, this is the thing, like, this is why Stan Gordon and obviously the people that work with him, their stuff really stands out, is because, you know, Stan Gordon is a person who, I don't believe he's ever actually seen a UFO. He's just a researcher. Like, he goes out, he speaks to people, you know, and he gets their, you know, their eyewitness statements. And these people, he vets them. And he can go, well, this person seemed to be genuine, and most of them are. And in fact, he's got a collection of reports from police officers, you know, who are expected to be held to a higher standard of truthfulness, usually, describing this infiltration of essentially skeletoid beings. So it's like, it's yeah, I know.
Real, fuckers! Is it real?
May as well play the full sample.
We will find out towards the end of the show, but let's jump into what you have been.
Yeah, Alistair Crowley and the Eon of Horus from Paul Weston. Huge, incredible work, 400 plus pages, just detailing every single individual, every obscure person involved, every kind of fringe topic connected with this crazy conspiracy board of you know, of diagrams. Paul begins by sharing how absolutely fascinated he was with the history of the 20th century as a young man. You know, he was obsessed with World War II. He absorbed everything he could, documentaries, books, the whole gamut. He was fascinated by the change in culture from the social revolution in the 1960s, how rock and roll became this huge force in the world, in the West, how the Beatles took over. And of course, he was a fan of these things. And in the introduction early on, he says, look, it started to dawn on me that history felt like a weird affair. He said, I read top historians took on board arguments for economic, sociological, and technological determinants. But he said, for all the growing mass of data and ideas that filled my head, something that felt like it ought to be cohering wasn't. He said, it's almost like there seemed to be a greater force behind what happened in the 20th century. He says, how remarkable was it that as Hitler, Himmler, and their associates reached the climax of their endeavors at Stalingrad and Auschwitz, so the grouping that included John Lennon, Bob Dylan, Jim Morrison, Jimi Hendrix, and Mick Jagger were coming into incarnation. He said, it seemed to me that the main players of the Nazi nightmare and the swinging 60s were rather specialized groups. He said the group of characters who were available to take the whole thing to the limit and beyond seemed to have been assembled by a brilliant casting agency. And generally, he's saying like the normal way of looking at history didn't explain to him satisfactorily why everything turned out to be so hideous and so strange and brilliant at the same time.
Mm.
And he felt like there was a deeper mystery behind it all, which is the force of his research. And the question that comes to mind is, what did that force have to do with Alistair Crowley? Like, is he involved in any way? So Weston shares that, you know, he first heard the name Crowley listening to David Bowie's album, Hunky Dory. And he later heard some BBC4 radio program about him, some documentary. And it was just intriguing. Like, who is this man? Who is this great beast everyone's talking about? Then one night in the early spring of 1980, he had this dream where there was this imposing bald-headed man looming over him in this darkened room. It's like a really strange dream. And that morning, he didn't think much of it. I mean, he's just going off to do some shopping, and he finds himself in a secondhand bookshop. And immediately, he's transfixed by this cover of the book The Great Beast by John Simmons. And of course, it's a biography of Alistair Crowley.
Does it have that classic image of him dressed in that Egyptian attire?
Yeah, he's wearing that magician's hat and he's the Egyptian eye on it. And immediately he's like, this is the guy from my dream. What the hell's going on? And he said an enduring fascination with the man and his work became a huge feature of his life. And finally, Crowley's concept of the Aeon of Horus became a metaphor of how to look at these strange, seemingly opposing forces of the 20th century. You know, you've got the Nazis, you've got communist revolutions, and then you've got this strange counterculture in the United States. You've got rock and roll music upending social norms, upending old orders. And this Aeon of Horus, from Crowley's philosophy, gave him this perspective. Because Crowley described history as being divided into these different eons, very much like the Yugas, each governed by their own principles, each governed by their own entities. And he described the Aeon of Isis, which was based on matriarchal societies, the idea that, you know, old tribes, older civilizations worshipped the goddess. Mm-hmm. The goddess was considered the mother goddess, was how you viewed divinity. It was through the lens of fertility and nature, the mystery of birth. And then this eon shifted into the Aeon of Osiris, he called it, which is the patriarchal societies where you have, you know, religions like Christianity, God dies and is resurrected. But this Aeon of Horus, he believed that this was a new era that started with his reception of the Book of the Law in 1904. And this was a kind of self-realization and self-actualization stage for humanity. It represents, he said, the child symbolizing the perfect integration of the masculine and feminine.
Okay.
All coming together in some
androgynous
mix. At least this is how it was packaged. How that turned out, we'll see. So, Crowley, if you're not familiar, if you're new to the show and you don't know who Aleister Crowley is, was considered, you know, in the 20th century, the most evil man in the world. But the guy was basically an occult magician.
Yeah.
You know, had his own magical order, you know, led several ones during his time. But the guy was a poet. He was hailed by some as a literary genius. You know, I think he was trained at Cambridge. Like, the guy was smart. He was also a monstrous degenerate. He was a pioneer of sexual freedom. He has endless lovers, you know, a string of illegitimate children across the world.
Oh, that weird connection between academia and perversion.
Yeah.
I don't know how that happens all the time.
Did you know that he held world mountaineering records?
I think vaguely I had heard something like that.
For a period of time, he had climbed higher in the Himalayas than anyone on Earth.
I didn't know that. What? For what purpose? Just hold the title?
This was his thing. Like, when he was young, he was a mountaineer.
He wasn't going up there to do some ritual?
No, he just liked climbing mountains. He also played chess to a standard approaching that of a grandmaster. And he was one of the first Westerners to, of course, fully be immersed in Eastern religions and bring some of that back to the West. Just a strange person. He was also one of the people who, I guess, was the first person to really, in the West, to experiment with mind-altering drugs and, you know, like mescaline, cocaine and heroin and all of that, and essentially make it like a more than just hedonism. There was some kind of magical purpose to it. But of course, he comes down to us as a magician. He was a member of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, mm-hmm. and went on to found the OTO and his own order later. And it's just his influence on the 20th century is kind of amazing. Like, he's connected to the kind of reemergence of witchcraft in the West. He's connected to the Nazis. And this is all spelled out, which I won't be focusing on this show. But
how is he connected to the Nazis?
Well, this is a whole thing in the Aeon of Horus from Paul Weston. He traces Crowley's ideas and the significant people that were connected to them and the very early start of the National Socialist Party in Germany.
So what, we're talking early 1930s, late 1920s?
Earlier than that.
Okay.
And then he's, of course, connected to the UFO phenomenon as well. He's connected to the rocketry program with his connection to Jack Parsons. So this is just one guy who seemed to have this force behind him that ended up in so many strange avenues that really did shape the direction of the world. And eventually I'm going to tie this back to one of the wildest stories you've ever heard, and that's the Montauk conspiracy. But I want to talk about how this book of law came to be. This was the most important event in his life. It occurred in Cairo in 1904. He believed he received a holy scripture that essentially described this new eon, this change for humankind. The previous year, he had been honeymooning there with his wife, Rose, and they'd spent a bit of time in Cairo. They'd basically passed through and somehow managed to spend the night in the Great Pyramid.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
And at the time, Crowley wasn't really involved in the whole occult magic thing. Like, he had done a lot of work with the Golden Dawn in the decade prior, a couple of years prior, like 1898 to 1900.
Wasn't he responsible for destabilizing the Golden Dawn, though?
Yeah, like, there's a whole other thing you can go into there. But basically, by 1904, he had taken a break. And he was really into climbing mountains. This is how he got all these mountaineering records. And he was traveling around the world. He was studying yoga and Buddhism. And he just wanted to be this romantic poet. And perhaps when he was staying in the Great Pyramid that night, as he and his wife Rose were passing through Cairo, it's speculated that he wanted to impress her, you know, with some of his knowledge of his magic days. So he did what he described as a little bit of an exhibition game in the king's chamber. He did some kind of magic ritual just to kind of impress his wife. Now, this may have been the catalyst that spurred on everything I'm going to explain to you.
Because, he opened a doorway to something?
Well, in February of 1904, they were back in Cairo, visiting again. And his wife, bizarrely, she started to slip into these altered states of consciousness. She started to go into these trances. And she would start telling Crowley that they were waiting for him. Now, Crowley stated that until that precise moment, she had no interest in the occult, no interest in magic, hadn't shown any signs of psychic abilities or slipping into trance or anything like that.
Yet she's somehow become a conduit for him.
And now she's giving him these messages. And at first he's dismissive of it, he's skeptical of it, but these trance states persist. And so he starts to question her. And then on March the 18th, she said that it was actually the Egyptian god Horus who was waiting for him. Now, as a result of this, Crowley was like, oh, I've got to get back into the magic. I've got to do something about this. This is getting wild. So he performed two ceremonial invocations to Horus. And they were interesting because the ritual details were supplied by Rose. They came through her trance state. She gave him instructions on what to say and what to do.
Does she have any recollection of this when she came out of it?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I don't think so. She went on to state that the equinox of the gods had come, that the old world, the epoch of Christianity, had been destroyed by fire on the inner planes. Something in other dimensions had happened. Whatever anchored Christianity to our material world was under threat in the other world. And at that crucial time, Crowley was to formulate a link between the solar spiritual force and humanity. It was up to him to establish some new spiritual path or connection because this old one was under threat.
There was only something I was reading recently that I'm picking my brain trying to recall, but essentially it was describing this otherworldly interdimensional disaster that had taken place, which was causing these refugees essentially of these beings from this other space to come to our reality. And that's why there was this sudden influx of weird high strangeness.
That's what Steiner talked about.
Oh, is it?
But I think it's an earlier period. I think he put this in like the mid to late 1800s, but he was saying the same thing, that there was basically a war in heaven. Another war in higher dimensions, and beings were basically sent down to Earth. But I don't want to get sidetracked because this is a convoluted story to say the least, because a few weeks later, his wife Rose, she starts stating that these messages that are coming through her aren't directly from Horus, but they're coming from his messenger, and it's an entity named Iwas. And eventually she gave Crowley instructions to enter a specially prepared room at noon on three successive days and be prepared to receive instruction. Now, this began on April the 8th. Crowley's sitting down at this desk in this prepared room, and Rose is there, and they're just sitting there waiting. And at exactly noon, he starts hearing this voice in the room. It seemed to originate from over his left shoulder, coming from like the corner of the room. And he said it. He felt it echo in his heart. He said this voice was very deep, very musical, expressive, solemn tones, a voluptuous, tender, fierce tone to it. And he said it was in English, but it was free of any accent or origin. As in, you know how when we're speaking, you can tell we're Australian, you can tell if someone's American, you can tell if someone's English. This didn't have that. And how can you even describe that? How can you hear English that doesn't have an origin? Like, at least you can pick something out. But this was like a pure English devoid of origin. And because this entity just started talking, Crowley didn't even have time to look over his shoulder. He just started to dictate. And this is what he was prepared to do. Rose was in the room as well. She heard it. But it's not stated whether she turned to look at the voice to see...
So there's actually a figure in the room or in the space.
If anyone's in there, like some guy standing in the room. Crowley did say he got a psychic impression of what Iwas looked like, though, and he describes a fine body, but it's transparent like smoke. He said he seemed to be a tall, dark man in his 30s, active and strong, with the face of a savage king, described his dress as being kind of Assyrian or Persian, but vaguely. And over the course of these three sessions, over 3 days, this book of law was dictated to Crowley. And Iwas introduced himself as Minister of Hur Parkrat, elsewhere known as Hur Parkred, or in Greek, Harpocrates. So this is the infant Horus. This is the representation of it. And he's usually represented with a finger to his lips. And this is, in a kind of occult magical sense, the sealing of a formula that's put into the world.
To do what?
Well, to have a magical effect. So you've got to think of what he's receiving as not just a collection of words, not just a collection of pages, but it's a formula. It's like a magical effect. It's got some kind of force in the world behind it. Now, each chapter contains the word of particular forces pictured in what Crowley came to call the stele of revealing. And arched over the whole scene was Nuit, the goddess of the night sky. And the first chapter, the first day, was hers. And it was all her coming through this deliverer, through Iwas. And, you know, I won't read the whole thing, obviously, but there's some quotes from her where she says, "Come forth, O children, under the stars and take your fill of love. I am above you and in you. My ecstasy is in yours. My joy is to see your joy." She says, "The word of sin is restriction. There is no bond that can unite the divided but love." It's all like super fluffy duffy new age stuff you would hear today on, you know, like an Amanda Noel video or something. "Also take your fill and will of love as ye will, when, where, and with whom you will, but always unto me. Invoke me under my stars. Love is the law, love under will."
Isn't it weird that it keeps on referencing love, though? Like, every time we cover these stories where people are being stuffed around by interdimensional entities or ETs, whatever, it always comes to, "Oh, it's about love." Like, is it, though?
Yeah,
why does it keep on throwing that in?
It's all love. You just got to choose love.
Yeah.
And finally, she says, "I, who am all pleasure and purple and drunkenness of the innermost sense, desire you. Put on the wings and arouse the coiled splendor within you. Come unto me." Very seductive, you know, all it's kind of very feminine, very welcoming, very encompassing. I'll encircle you. I'll be your protector.
Like a succubus.
And then the next day comes Hadit, this other entity through Iwas. And this one's very different. He says, "I am the flame that burns in every heart of man and in the core of every star. I am life and the giver of life, yet therefore is the knowledge of me the knowledge of death." Listen to that line for a moment. This is 1904.
Say it again.
"I am the flame burns in the heart of every man and in the core of every star. In me is the knowledge of death."
It's got an as above, so below kind of feel to it.
What do we see that develops in the 20th century? In the 20th century, nuclear power, nuclear weapons. There's been a connection to that. He says later, I am the snake that giveth knowledge and delight and bright glory and stir the hearts of men with drunkenness.
Oh, so that's biblical.
To worship me, take wine and strange drugs, whereof I will tell my prophet and be drunk thereof. They shall not harm ye at all. It is a lie, this folly against self. So in other words, go and take that mescaline, go and take that LSD, take those drugs. It won't harm you. This is where you'll receive my insight. Be strong, O man, lust. Enjoy all things of sense and rapture. Fear not that any god shall deny thee for this. Don't have any restrictions. Don't worry about old formalities and forbearance. Make sure you just let yourself go and experience all the sensual delights.
But we know that, you know, from the discussions we've had about spirit possession, for example, is that if you lead that completely hedonistic lifestyle, you leave yourself open and vulnerable to these things.
And then you're totally right. And then it gets even more disturbing because it starts to become, and this is later connected to the emergence of, you know, the Nazis and National Socialism. He says, we have nothing with the outcast and the unfit. Let them die in their misery, for they feel not. Compassion is the vice of kings. Stamp down the wretched and the weak. This is our law and the joy of the world. As in, don't worry about compassion. Don't worry about looking out for those less fortunate than you. Crush them. They're not up to our excellence. Destroy them. So the third day, you have the emergence of the final entity, Rahur Kuit. He comes through as like, and there's like a three-force relationship with these entities. So Nuit represents infinite space, like the chaotic potential of an empty universe. Mm-hmm. And Hadit comes in as the like yang to that yin, as like the dot within her circle. He represents manifestation, the male side. And then Rahur Kuit is the, I guess, offspring of this union of the yin and the yang, represents their child, represents creation. And he basically becomes the, I guess, the master of the world, of the created world. He says, I am a god of war and vengeance. Thou shalt have danger and trouble. Worship me with fire and blood. Mercy let be of, damn them who pity. Kill and torture, spare not, be upon them. With my hawk's head, I peck at the eyes of Jesus as he hangs upon the cross. Let Mary inviolate be torn upon wheels. For her sake, let all chaste women be utterly despised among you. So really disgusting, abhorrent, evil. Clearly some kind of demon coming through. And Crowley's like, well, I better get this down.
But that's what I don't understand. I mean, he must have already have had some, I guess, moral compromises if he just listened to something like that and then not inherently go, well, that doesn't sound good.
But you got to put this in the context of the old world being
torn down.
Yeah, torn down and unhinged. And so the idea, as evil and distorted as this is, like the old ideal of some kind of upright religion like Christianity being the foundation of a civilization, that is now gone and there's a totally new rule set. And so he has this entity coming through saying, this is the rule set, war and vengeance, blood and torture. And this is
it's
the...
It's no Buddhism, is it?
No, this is like this is the force. He's being told this is the force that's going to shape the new eon for humanity. Well, and what follows?
Well, about to say, in a way, it's true.
Because World War I, World War II,
yep.
Communist revolutions, the Nazis.
Well, the Holocaust.
The Holocaust, yeah, exactly. All this stuff followed. So Crowley did not write this. As in, Crowley was not the author of this. And he maintained this to his dying day. I did not write this. And he actually sat on those last, sections I read from that final entity. He knew it was evil. He sat on it. He didn't want to publish it. He thought it was disgusting. But over time, Crowley was seducted by this force.
Mm-hmm.
And on one of the pages of the original version of his handwritten copy, there's this grid he's drawn. he's drawn a grid of squares encompassing the words that have been dictated to him from this voice in the room. And he's got these lines passing on an angle. He's trying to match up where these sentences are structured. He's drawing a circle around it. And essentially, there's a sense that Crowley knew not to entirely trust what he was being given, that it was a cipher. He was trying to break a cipher. There was a code in here.
So are you saying there's a potential that Crowley may have been not always that evil, but perhaps because he was pursuing something so much that it consumed him?
Yeah, like he, from a magical perspective, he may have thought, well, this is a test. You know, maybe there's some secret to unlock here. And it was actually dictated to him by the entities that fit in the chance shape of the letters and their position to one another in these are mysteries that no beast shall divine. And it starts talking about the circling the square and all this sort of stuff.
But basically, so, you go from channeling, you know, a couple of entities to screwing your male assistant in the desert trying to summon a demon.
Yeah, exactly.
You can see this somewhat hell of a gateway, you know, channeling.
Think about it. Like, the guy was happily married. He was climbing mountains. You know, he was super
visiting
fit.
Egypt.
He's becoming like a chess grandmaster. He's traveling the world with his wife. He's got a fantastic life. And then he starts receiving this message. And yeah, you're right. Like, 20 years later, he's trying to channel Pan in the desert with some like homosexual ritual. It's just, it's bizarre. So the thing for Paul Weston is that this concept of the Aeon of Horus, this shifting of the, the force that drives humankind, gives you like a superb metaphor, he says, for understanding the 20th century. And he says, look, there's been an explosive unleashing of knowledge and energy and symbol that's been symbolized by Hadith, this message of the flame that burns in the heart of every man and in the core of every star. Like, look at LSD, the atom bomb, DNA being discovered, the space program. Look at the changes that we saw as a civilization in this period, but the destruction as well.
That's the thing. I mean, in some way, some of these developments have been, you know, a blessing for humanity. Like, they really have been. The way that we have now technology and instantaneous communication and, you know, just so many different things. But then at the same time, they've come at such a cost,
Good point.
I wonder if there's some of us that just go, would it be better if we just didn't have any of it?
Yeah.
So we didn't have to go through that.
What if we rewound to the 1800s before this bald freak received this message? So this is where it gets super weird, because you look away from Crowley to another unique individual in this time period. And you've got to think, like, did anyone else in this time period start to notice that the epoch was changing, that the aeon was shifting to something else, that the psyche of the West was about to transform? And the answer is yes. The answer is Carl Jung, but not in a way you might expect. You see, in the middle of the First World War, Jung had this crazy psychic encounter with this Gnostic deity.
What do you mean?
Okay, so he encountered Abraxas.
What's Abraxas?
So Abraxas, so let me break this down. So the Gnostics, very much in a nutshell, believe the material world was created by a secondary deity you might consider evil, right? And the highest God is obviously above all of this, above all of creation. And, you know, something in the idea of the Christian Satan is there, but also the Old Testament Jehovah might be a candidate. But essentially, there's a host of entities that are controlling powers, keeping this matrix in place, which is our prison of this dimension, right? The material world is like a prison that has to be transcended. This is what the Gnostics believed. And Abraxas, usually depicted as like a human with a rooster's head, legs like serpents. Sometimes he's got a hawk's head or a lion's head, holds a whip and a shield. Basically, he's associated with the concept of this archon of our material world. Like, he manages it. He's in charge of the prison. He's the warden, so to speak, right? And he's the same concept as Rahu Kuit, that third entity that came through to Crowley. He's like the unifier of opposites. He's the offspring of the yin and yang, right? So he was associated with one of the leading Gnostics in the, I think, the first century. His name is Basilides. And he started to write about this Abraxas entity. And sometime between the summer of 1916 and February 1917, Jung encountered this entity. And not many people know about this. Apparently, this is a pretty obscure thing that wasn't revealed until, you know, after Jung's death. But
I don't believe I've ever heard this.
Over three consecutive evenings, according to Weston, Jung had the same experience as Crowley. He wrote seven sermons to the dead. And this,
hey, are you saying that he channeled something?
Yeah. So listen to this. Around this time period, over this, you know, period of 3 days, just like Crowley, all this weird stuff started to happen in Jung's home. Like, his children started to see entities, ghosts, strange noises. One of his kids had a really full-on dream of an angel and a devil. Jung himself felt this strange atmosphere in the home building, like something was bubbling up, something was about to happen. And on Sunday afternoon, their doorbell started ringing, but no one was there. And they so actually,
like a weird electrical stuff going on.
Well, they actually, because it's an old school thing. It's like an old manual thing.
It's like an actual physical effect.
They saw the apparatus moving on its own. Like some unseen force was pushing it. Like the air in the house just felt so full with spirits that Jung felt like it was hard to breathe. And he eventually cried out, "For God's sake, what in the world is this?" And he claims that he received like a reply in a chorus of voices saying, "We have come back from Jerusalem where we found not what we sought." And Jung felt that the barriers between worlds had broken down with all this activity in his house and this strange feeling in the air. He sits down to write. Now, like Crowley, he claims he didn't write this. He claims it was Basilides. It was this Gnostic from the first century that was coming through, and Jung, in some kind of automatic writing, started to pump out this work.
It makes you start thinking, though, because Jung was extremely influential in a number of different, you know, social upheavals, I suppose. Like, his theories are revolutionary, and he's extremely well known, certainly in the parapsychological kind of, you know, realm.
Yeah, yeah.
But did that happen? Like, did these entities seek out Crowley and Jung because they knew what they would become, or did they become this because of the help from the entities?
I think it's a little from column A and a little from column B.
It's just
like the idea that their ideas aren't their own is something to think about, that work is informed by something exterior to themselves, some external intelligent force that's trying to shape the world in a different way.
It makes me think about Jung, because Jung was fighting with Freud. Like, we know that he was, obviously had a very different approach to things, and he started pushing back against Freud's ideas because Freud pushed a lot of it away. Mm. But with Jung, it's almost like, because Jung started encountering synchronicities, like that's what kind of opened him to this other realm, this other way of thinking, this other reality. But I was talking before about gateways. Was that like the precursor to this kind of stuff happening?
You're really onto something there, and I'll expand on that in a moment. But essentially what came through Jung in this automatic writing was this entity, this Basilides, who claimed to be from like the second century AD. He seemed to be part of this group of crusading knights who failed to find fulfillment in Jerusalem. In other words, they couldn't find it through conventional Christianity. And their God concept got a makeover when they encountered Abraxas. And they describe, and this is what Jung wrote, it's Abraxas who is undefinable life itself, which is the mother of good and evil alike. He is the brightest light of day and the deepest night of madness. He is both the radiance and the dark shadow of man. Abraxas generates truth and falsehood, good and evil, light and darkness, with the same word and in the same deed. Therefore, Abraxas is truly the terrible one. He is the monster of the underworld, the octopus with 1,000 tentacles. He is the twistings of winged serpents and of madness. To fear him is wisdom. Not to resist him means liberation. Again, there's this dark undercurrent to it.
I'm also intrigued. Maybe it's nothing, but I start to wonder, like with the threes, right? Three is this number that comes up in occult circles. It's also, it's got a biblical reference with the idea of the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost, like this triad. And yet these entities are doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah. And getting back to what you were saying with what Jung was practicing, this is what Western starts to explore, because there's the idea, like some people might think, well, how is Jung having this full-on occult automatic writing session? Like, this is crazy. Well, some commenters say that Jung was more of a magician than a psychologist. He practiced what's known to Jungians as active imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially sometimes this would involve sitting down and imagining yourself as some other entity. This is precisely the same thing you would see in like esoteric Tibetan Buddhism, for example, where you picture yourself as like a goddess or a god or something.
But it also connects into things like, I think it was utilized for lucid dreaming, out of body projection.
Yeah.
You know, those kind of
things. And he actively cultivated this stuff. Like in 1913, this Philemon character appeared to him, this white-bearded sage with multicolored kingfisher wings appeared to him in this vision. And Jung described him as having this like Egyptian Hellenistic atmosphere. Mm. And in this typical Jungian synchronicity, I think following this weird vision, this encounter, he found a dead kingfisher. And
it's a synchronicity.
Yeah, like this is in Switzerland, though, where there's no kingfishers. Like this, you know, the odds of finding a kingfisher in that area are just impossible, and he's never seen one again. So Philemon, this entity, became a guru to Jung, guiding him through these visionary experiences. And the climax of Jung's experiences only recently became widely known through this other researcher named Richard Knoll, who discovered that one night in December of 1913, in one of these active imagination states, Jung started to experience something strange. He claims he had a snake start wrapping itself around his body. And as it did so, he found himself taking on a crucifixion pose and his head changing shape into that of a lion. And essentially, Jung had assumed the God form of the Lord of Time. And this is all, you know, getting very similar to Abraxas, this unifier of opposites that he would encounter in this automatic writing session later. And so the question that comes up here and that Western explores is, did Crowley encounter the same force, the same intelligence that Jung encountered? Is it the same entity?
It terrifies me to think that they did, but that seems likely.
Well, Seven Sermons, this thing that he channeled, wasn't published until after his death in 1961. So not many of his followers even knew about it. Some copies were apparently distributed amongst a select few, but it was basically, you know, no one knew about this thing. So Crowley had no knowledge of it. You know, because Crowley died in like the late 1940s. So compare this to the passages from Liber 7, which was one of Crowley's later works, and compare this to Jung writing about this entity Abraxas. Crowley wrote, "O all ye toads and cats, rejoice, ye slimy things, come hither, dance, dance to our Lord God." So that's Crowley. Jung wrote, "He is the Lord of toads and frogs, who lives in water and comes out onto the land, and who sing together at high noon and at midnight."
What's the term that you used before? You said the unifier of opposites. Is that what these entities are supposed to be?
Yeah.
When you think about it, Crowley and Jung couldn't be more opposite.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're different characters. But, I mean, they're still involved in this occult.
Well, this is the unifier.
Occult practice. So, "Oh, all ye toads and cats, rejoice." And then Jung writes, "He is the Lord of toads and frogs." I mean, just the way the sentences are structured and the way that the passage works, is it all it's from strange. The same entity? And I started to think, like, the Lord of Toads and Frogs, and we're talking about Egyptian entities. And this is all tied to this Abraxas figure. Maybe there's something behind this. Maybe the Abraxas unifier of opposites is a lie, because who's the Lord of Frogs in Egyptian cosmology? Well, it's the Lord Keck. And to understand this...
Are you serious?
Yeah, to understand this, like, we've got to have an aside and go to 4chan, where, you know, Gary Lachman wrote about this in his book Dark Star Rising, where he put forward this idea that, you know, Trump winning the presidency in 2016 had some kind of occult force behind it. Now, no matter what you think of that, whether that's crazy or some kind of thing to speculate on, the fact is that he points this out. Users on 4chan, you know, 4chan's anonymous, right? And when you post something on 4chan, there's an 8-digit number that signifies it's like the mark of your post. Mm. And sometimes, obviously, these numbers, they're strings of, like, you know, 9 digits or something. Sometimes they have doubles in them. Sometimes they have triple numbers in them. They're totally random. So if you have a post that's like tagged number 7656344, that's called a trip because you got 3 fours in it. And you don't know what number you're going to get until you post. So, you know, it's like you'll see users, they'll say something ridiculous like, World War III is going to start tomorrow, you know, trips, if it's true. And sometimes they'll post it and they'll actually get trips. So it's considered, it's like some kind of prophetic meaning. And then you have dubs when you get doubles and so on. And if you get dubs or trips, it's considered they would call it a get. And you would basically type kek if you got it, as in, you know, look at my post.
Is that a poker reference, like trips?
No, so Keck actually goes back to, Lachman says it goes back to World of Warcraft, but I think it actually goes back to StarCraft. Because if you typed LOL, if you typed LOL, it would come out as Keck, because that's the Korean. Korean version is Keck. There's some, you know, Korean origin story to it, but it basically caught on and people would type Keck, right? So what started to happen in 2015 is that people would post about Trump on 4chan. And users started to notice that...
You get more trips when you write about Trump?
Yeah, they were getting dobs, trips, and quads, like 4 numbers in this string, if you wrote something about Trump.
You know, it's almost like the Global Consciousness Project, where they had the random number generators around the world, and when there was some type of force or effect that was going to occur, those numbers would line up more often. Yeah. This is kind of the same thing in an abstract way.
Yeah, you're right. So Lachman was saying... This was just the beginning, because the number of trips and gets that people were getting seemed to suggest that Trump was receiving some kind of magical help, like there was some occult force behind his run for presidency. And this was confirmed for many users, he wrote, when one of them noticed something odd. So obviously we remember that Pepe was huge back in, you know, this time period, right? And people started to realize that Pepe is like, when you think about it, Pepe seemed like a postmodern online version, an incarnation of the ancient Egyptian frog-headed deity, Keck. His name is Keck. People are typing Keck.
So what did that deity do? Was he a deity of humor or something like that?
Keck is the god of chaos.
Ah.
So if you go to the ancient Egyptian cosmogony of the eightfold Ogdoad, Ogdoad means eightfold, Keck is, guess what, an androgynous entity personifying the power of primordial darkness and the coming forth of day, the shifting from night to day. And what are we talking about here? We're talking about Jung and Crowley channeling these entities who are saying there's a new dawning coming. There's a new age coming. There's a breakdown of the old. We're heading through this primordial chaos into the new era.
Well, subconsciously, without even, you know, I know obviously we're talking about this, but when you're describing that, in my mind, I'm like, oh, that's very Jungian. I'm like, well, we're actually talking about Jung.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's exactly what it is.
He says most authorities agree that Keck represents primordial darkness, but that with his feminine aspect, he personifies the shift from darkness to light or night into day. And of course, if you look at primordial darkness is basically chaos.
And it has been chaos. In the last, you know, decade, it really has been chaos.
Well, Lachman makes the point, like, to have something new manifest in terms of like chaos magic approach. This is how they view it. And I don't agree with any of this stuff. Let me just put that out there, that I don't practice in any of this, and I'm not sure about whether it's good in any way. But they claim that if you have chaos, if you have this primordial darkness, it's the perfect atmosphere, it's the perfect environment for your desires to manifest. So if there is an entity that wants to tear down the old and create something new, it needs to be an entity of this nature. It needs to be an entity that's of the nature of chaos. And it seems as though, you know, Abraxas is one idea, but this lord of chaos, this Egyptian god of Kek, with Crowley writing, "All ye toads and cats rejoice." Jung writing, "He is the lord of toads and frogs." Kek is the frog-headed Egyptian god of chaos.
So is this an individual kind of thing? Like, we're talking about Crowley, we're talking about Jung, but to, you know, create any type of effect, any type of influence, does it need to be greater? Like, and so obviously Crowley and Jung became influential in circles, and their knowledge has spread out. And even what you're talking about with 4chan, like, it's obviously has built a social construct, a following behind it.
Yeah.
Is this how it kind of builds? It's like a flywheel?
I guess you can think of it as an egregore, in that it's building, you know, as more people follow the thinking, it starts to get stronger and has more effect in the world.
But is there a point where it becomes overwhelming, where it elicits a change?
Well, I think you've got to think of it in the terms of what was explained to Crowley, and that the foundation that in higher dimensions that anchored Christianity to the West was somehow severed or damaged. That plays a key in this whole thing, because you move from Jung and Crowley to another major figure that ties all of this together at exactly the same time period.
Who?
And that's George Gurdjieff.
Oh.
So you remember when we were at the Theosophical Library in Sydney, and we would just see Gurdjieff books, like, yeah, everywhere you looked? The guy was, you know, a real force in the world. He was a mystic. He was a philosopher, spiritual teacher, composer. He was born in what was the Russian Empire, but which is now Armenia. He was born in, I think, the 1870s, something, but passed away in 1949. But he basically developed a spiritual way. He called it the work, or the fourth way. He emphasized integration of knowledge, self-discipline. There were some physical movements involved. It basically facilitating transformation, spiritual development, and huge influence. And he wrote this gigantic and almost impossible to read book called Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. And a lot of the material in this strange book is clearly autobiographical. Like, it's clearly Gurdjieff being on the scene, seeing what's going on and narrating it. And it's got this really strange account of something that happened in Tibet at precisely the time that Aleister Crowley started to receive this Book of Law transmission.
Was he directly involved, or it's just a coincidence that it's the same time?
Gurdjieff.
No, Crowley.
No, well, Crowley's in Egypt at the time. I'm talking Tibet. So this is Tibet, 1903. There was a British expedition that entered the country. It was led by a man named Francis Younghusband. It wasn't like a British invasion or anything, but it was like a military force, and, you know, they did have political aspirations. They basically wanted to force Tibet into opening up more to British influence. Now, Gurdjieff was in Tibet during this period, and this strange book he wrote, Beelzebub's Tales, gives an account of the history of this esoteric group that was in Tibet. And this group, very secretive, they always numbered only 7 people. They had been founded, according to Gurdjieff, by a divine messenger, some Saint Krishnakarna, he said. So some kind of, it could be referring to Krishna, some ancient saint. This group endured and adapted through the time of Buddha, and the arrival of his teaching in Tibet, and eventually with its adoption by the founder of Tibetan Buddhism. This group was always behind the scenes, always having influence, always having power, always numbering 7. So this sounds very much like the Great White Brotherhood.
Yes, I'm thinking the Theosophy.
The Secret Chiefs.
Yes.
The Ascended Masters. It's the same kind of idea, right? This group was very powerful, very mysterious. And Gurdjieff stated that they played a role in global forces. Like they could shape the direction of the world, right? That's how much influence and power they had from an occult mystical perspective. Now, they were still active, very much so, when this British force entered Tibet in 1903 under this young husband guy. And the leader of this seven was actually present at a kind of national assembly where they discussed how's Tibet going to greet the British? Like, how are we going to handle the British influence? We've got to be careful here. And this leader of the seven advocated pacifism. He wanted a pacifist approach. Of course, the Tibetan leaders adopted this approach, and they actually sent a group out to meet the British. And this leader of the seven, this spiritual adept, this ascended master, he was with this group. And it went horribly wrong. He was shot dead.
Why? What happened?
Well, I've pictured it in my mind 1,000 times and I kind of think it's hilarious. Like this powerful spiritual master who's the head of this mysterious secret group that like lives in the Himalayas.
He didn't have some weird personal auric shield or something.
He's got superpowers. He can teleport all around the world and he goes to meet the British and the British are like, what old chap? What's this old chap? Supernormal powers, eh? Well,
take my musket.
That's very good, old boy. Stand over here. Just stand over there. You're right there. Now, regiment, aim, fire.
That's awful.
And he's dead.
That is truly awful.
It's like the British Empire really didn't care about his occult powers at all. They just shot him dead.
But it's kind of like the whole Star Wars thing, though. Did they just strike him down? He became more powerful.
No. Here's the thing, right? According to Gurdjieff, this group of seven
became six.
That now he claims they had been around for 1,000 years, right? And because they had this occult power, all of these individuals were like multiple lifetimes of man in age. Now the group was obviously fatally compromised. And this was spectacularly bad timing because this leader of the seven who was shot dead by the British was apparently on the verge, according to Gurdjieff, of becoming the divine messenger of the new age.
Oh.
He was about to emerge from this secret location in Tibet.
Could have saved humanity.
And lead humanity into this new eon of spiritual ascendancy. Now, the six that are left are like, fuck, what do we do? What do we do? We thought we were immortals.
I know. Well, fuck over humanity.
No, they took a hardcore esoteric option. Like they were desperate. They attempted to communicate with their leader who had passed on, who had been shot by the British.
Oh, of course they would. Yes, that makes sense.
By attempting to communicate through his corpse.
Oh.
So they had this full, like, Tibetan master Weekend at Bernie's episode where they, like, had him set up in a, like, rolling him around, saying everything's fine, trying to conjure. They were, you know how in Eastern mysticism you got the idea of the soul that ascends and there's the soul that remains mm-hmm. behind? I think they were trying to contact the soul that remained behind and get instruction on how to proceed and what to do.
Does it describe any attributes? Did he become something like those incorruptibles where he didn't decompose, or was it that his body just started falling apart?
What happened when they tried this Weekend at Bernie's ritual to try and contact him through his corpse? Some kind of, according to Gurdjieff, some kind of negative alchemic disaster happened and there was a ginormous explosion.
You mean like a psychic explosion?
Almost a literal nuclear explosion in the mountains in Tibet. It caused a huge like landslide. Half the mountain was blown
away.
What
were they doing?
All of the remaining group was killed in the explosion, and all the texts and ancient relics and scrolls from ancient history were destroyed in this disaster. And this disaster meant that planetary conditions as a whole immediately deteriorated. Because this group and this individual was prophesized to be the coming Maitreya, the return of the king of the world. It was all destroyed. And the timing is spectacular because
I'm getting the end of the Planet of the Apes at the moment.
This is true because if you look at the Young Husband expedition on March the 31st, you know, this is probably what Gurdjieff was talking about. British and Tibetan forces faced each other at point blank range, and it looked like there was going to be a peaceful resolution. There were discussions in progress when suddenly a shot was fired. This is from the history books. And the Tibetans realized one of their own was shot. And from Gurdjieff's story, it's this future king of the world.
Were they just trigger happy?
Well, we don't know. There's probably some. Maybe there was an English soldier who hadn't had his second breakfast that morning and he was a bit tired and he just slipped. But this is what you got to put it in the context of. Non-human forces behind
that's
this.
What I'm thinking.
The idea that some spiritual adept with that power, if any of this is true, that is going to be the king of the world and lead the world into a new aeon can be killed means that something in another dimension has been sabotaged.
Yes. Right?
Something has been destroyed in another dimension that allows them to become mortal. And 700 Tibetans were killed. Now, Crowley, at the precise time that this happened, he's receiving the channeled information from this entity claiming that the foundation of spirituality in the world has now been destroyed. It's been damaged.
It really does have to be more than a coincidence. It has to be.
He's being told that there's a whole new era coming because of what's just happened. And Gurdjieff had this story of this guy being shot in Tibet. Now, this ties in with Ferdinand Ossendowski. Remember Ossendowski traveled through, Asia in the, 1890s? And that's the old, remember the Shambhala mystery, mm-hmm. the whole king of the world prophecy? And that was the same idea, that this king of the world was encased in this kind of hidden, hidden away from the world in Shambhala. And that was the prophecy that he was going to emerge and there would be a new life on earth purified by the death of nations. That was the prophecy. And the super beings of Agartha would rise up. And we've always made fun that it's like the mole people. But that was the great philosophy. That was the great prophecy.
Well, I mean,
and it was like that was destroyed. Destroyed that.
Yeah, I mean, there's always been conflict. There's always been battles and wars and, perhaps, compromised morality and all that kind of stuff all throughout, history. But when you actually think about it, like if you look at, like on a graph and you just think about major events, like you have this alleged destruction and then essentially you fall into World War One, it kills millions of people. Then you get World War Two, which kills millions of people, also commits one of the worst atrocities, if not the worst atrocity to ever happen to humanity. And then we get the Cold War with so many more people. Then we get nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Then like everything is just kind of gotten worse.
And it's the ideas behind them that become the material effects in the world. It's not like a bunch of people. Like people have been killing each other for years,
of course.
Since the inception of humankind. But there was something about the ideas that spread in the 20th century. There was something about the thinking that changed, and it's the idea that this entity that essentially spoke to Jung, spoke to Gurdjieff, or not spoke to Gurdjieff, but spoke to Crowley. Was the inception of these ideas. It was connected
and
to these ideas.
You know what? It might have some type of, an innate immunity of some kind to be able to allow itself to not only proliferate, but also to allow itself to be protected from any uprisals. And what I mean by that is that, prior to this, right, you really didn't have people readily dismissing anything that was esoteric. Like, yes, it was, but at the same point, people were more, for God's sake, people were having seance parties around this time, right? People were more willing to engage in the supernatural, the spiritual side of things, the other world, the non-materialistic. This explosion happens, and now it's like any idea of anything esoteric, indulging anything that's spiritual, anything that's even new age, today it's completely ostracized. completely ostracized. The only thing we've got recently is a little bit of technology with government saying, oh yeah, maybe there's UFOs. But that's all nuts and bolts and technological and materialistic.
Yeah.
It's like it, because people were fearful now of being ridiculed, they're not going to even bother to indulge in anything. So whatever is the opposing force, it can't fight back.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And Weston looks at this from a similar way at what the Nazis did to Western civilization.
Obliterated it.
Like, completely obliterated it because, you know, he says, like, things like patriotism, things like having love for your nation, having love for your people, having love for your country, they twisted
yeah,
that.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
It became something evil and horrible. And it's like after that, the West was like, oh, we can't do those things anymore.
Yeah.
Can't touch any of that.
Yep.
But those are the things that traditionally had been the foundation of great nations and great people.
Well, it kind of allowed some homogenous kind of communities to spring up. You know, people were, you were part of a nation. It didn't matter who you were. Or what your identity was, it was like you're part of a nation and you have patriotism. Yeah, but now, you're right, it's like patriotism, especially even today, it's like considered to be this most abhorrent, terrible, ultra-right wing thing. And
totally,
it's not.
It totally killed it. Totally killed it for the West. And, you know, Weston goes into this, and I'll link to the book in the show notes, The Aeon of Horus, because there's a deep dive he does on all of this that is way beyond the scope of the show. It's just too much to go into. Like, for example, after this, this is where he starts to trace how these ideas from Crowley and these entities essentially led to National Socialism and to some of these other forces in the 20th century. Like, the next chapter is called The Hippie Reich.
Yeah, you were telling me about this.
And he ultimately ties this into the counterculture movement in the 1960s, to the drug use in America, to rock and roll. And I had no idea that hippies originated in 19th century German youth. I had no idea. It's so bizarre. So in the closing years of the 19th century, there was this German youth movement that became really popular. And it rapidly expanded. Anyone in their mid-teens would be in this, or late teens, tens of thousands of young Germans who ultimately became
the Hitler youth.
Yeah, like the youth of the Reich. They would basically became hippies. Like, they dressed like medieval minstrels. They wore woolen caps. They, you know, played guitar and wandered the countryside. They would sing old folk songs around fires, camp in the woods. They would gather at ruined castles. It was like the spirit of Woodstock. In the youth of Germany, they did nude bathing in the rivers of lakes, and camps were created in the countryside. They created these little communes everywhere. And this actually became the foundation of the youth hostel network. That's where it comes from. The Youth Reich.
That's incredible. Right?
They came to be termed the Wanderwogel, which is like, it's a term for migratory birds, but they were just wandering around the country like free as a bird.
Oh, as in like Wanderlust.
Yeah, they had this pagan mysticism about them, Western rites. And they started to develop these ideas about blood and soil and the people, and this started to focus on the German race. And
also became eugenics.
No, well, this is all later. It's like this got twisted later by the Tuhula Society and, you know, the National Socialists, but, you know, they had sun worship. They're basically hippies. They're just like pagan hippies. And there's a photo of them from like 1926, where they're all kind of half naked, holding hands, just like you would see from 1960s California. But there's like the swastika and the German sun symbol there.
But the swastika at that point, wasn't that like a symbol of peace? That in the East, it's a symbol of peace. Or is it, are you saying this is a Nazi swastika?
This is 1926. This is before the Nazis. Mm. I'm just pointing out the connection.
I'm just wondering, at what point did they then morph into the perversion of Nazism?
Well, this came later, you know, after the formation of the National Socialists. So they had everything that the hippies in the 60s and 70s had. And even today with the New Age types, they had landscape mysticism. They were all into runes, nudist sun worship, big time vegetarians. Like, everything was about vegetarianism and being vegan, huge into health food. They had all these concerns about the soil and everything needed to be organic. They had all sorts of social ideas about, you know, the fluidity of being a female or a male and about animal liberation. Like, they're just like massive lefty hippies,
my
right?
My eyes are just like rolling back as far as I can in my head.
And eventually, a lot of them emigrated to America, specifically California. Isn't it amazing? And they became this new thought movement.
So over a century.
And this kind of barefooted, long-haired, bearded, hippie look, playing guitars, wandering around, having communes, this came from these Germans in the late 1800s.
But is he suggesting that it, like, yeah, it came from the Germans, but there was some force, some esoteric force that caused it?
Well, eventually Europe had its own Esalen. You know how California has the Esalen Institute, which became this kind of vanguard of all these New Age ideas. Mm-hmm. There was a similar one in Switzerland, this lake near Ascona, and they had this little center there, and people like Hermann Hesse went there, Steiner went there, Lenin went there, Jung went there. It was like this, it was where you would go to get the cutting edge of the new ideas, right? And it became like a think tank for all this stuff that started to spread. And there was a connection with San Francisco. Like, the San Francisco was writing about them, and there was a connection to the hippies in America. And basically the Nazis, those young people became the young Nazis, and the idealism and dynamism of this group, it was totally exploited by the National Socialists. Like, it was appropriated by the Nazis.
Wondering, is that because they were using the swastika? Is that where Hitler grabbed it from?
I don't know if that's specifically where. Like, I think the Tahula Society was using it, but the whole package was basically that these hippies were using was hijacked by the Hitler Youth, and the joyful wandering out in nature, the songs around the campfire, the camaraderie was the hook, and essentially it became totally twisted by National Socialism as we know. And so there's a whole thing to go into there. There's a whole, like, strand that he follows and connects this to various ideas of Hitler being involved in the occult. And there's this other connection with Philip K. Dick that I didn't put in my notes, but just recall it now, where at around the same time that I think it was Jack Parsons. So Jack Parsons, of course, was one of the founders of the Jet Propulsion Labs that still works JPL. With NASA.
Yep.
Of course, you know, gifted chemical scientist, rocketry scientist. Was he a rocketry scientist? No, a chemical scientist. He was, you know, instrumental in the war effort with America. He ended up making discoveries that led to planes, you know, being able to have jet propulsion, being able to take off from aircraft carriers, things like that. He had a security clearance. But he was also in Aleister Crowley's OTO Magical Order, and he was a disciple of Crowley. He very much followed Crowley's ideas, and we mentioned this briefly on the Plus show, and we've covered this on a whole show, but he basically wanted to create a magical working that would channel in an entity that would essentially shape this age of Horus, this eon of Horus that was starting to emerge. Parsons saw this happening with World War II, with the revolutions. He was like, clearly there's a force in the world, but we need to shape it. We need to mold it. So his idea was, we need to create a moon child. And the moon child is, you basically do an occult ritual, have sex with a woman, get her pregnant, and then the child that is born is like,
like a messiah?
Some kind of entity from another dimension, like a demon or a god or something, right?
But it's going to usher in a new era.
Yeah, he wants to call in the holy goddess, like some kind of the whore of Babylon, but the idea is it's like a temple priestess, the idea of like a sacred whore is going to come through. So he and L. Ron Hubbard get this young redhead girl and have this massive sex orgy with her. And then I love that afterwards they tell her, oh, this is for a ritual so that you'll have the moon child. She's like, oh, okay. I was just happy with all the sex orgy, but I guess I'll have the moon child as well.
And did she have it?
No. Well, ultimately what happened with Jack Parsons, as many of you probably know, is that he blew himself up in some crazy accident, people say.
Yeah, but with that, even that's got esoteric and occult elements, you know, rumors surrounding that he was trying to do something that was occult based, and well, that's why it exploded.
It was called the Babylon Working, and if I've got the details correct, the tie-in with Philip K. Dick is that as Parsons was doing the Babylon working, trying to conjure this entity, the Nag Hammadi texts were discovered in what the Middle they? East. They're the, like the Gnostic texts that are, you know, 1,000 years old or okay. something. And Philip K. Dick, you know how he had that visionary experience?
Well, he had multiples of them, but yes.
He saw some pink laser beam and then he saw Rome superimposed over Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Like he was living in Rome simultaneously while he was living in Los Angeles. He remembered this weird past life. Anyway, through this past life in Rome, he saw that there was an entity that was essentially attached to these Gnostic codexes, the Nag Hammadi scripts. And the entity acted as a force in the world in that it spread almost like a virus. Like these Gnostic ideas, you would hear people talking about them and then they would take root in your mind.
So it's literally a mind virus.
It would be like a mind virus. But he also claimed that it could spread in the air. Like you could catch it without even hearing about it. Now he claims that when Gnosticism was persecuted, this entity was almost like a Dybbuk box. It was sealed away with these Gnostic codexes, with these scrolls, and it was sealed away in these jars, right? And it was basically kept there in slumber for 1,000 years.
So you mean like a genie kind of style, if someone broke the vessel, escape?
And Philip K. Dick says when the Nag Hammadi codexes were discovered, apparently the guy that found them in the cave, you know, when he lifted up the jar, that's what he said. He said this weird gold, like ephemeral dust came out of the jar, almost like a smoke. And people have commented and said, obviously that's like old dust and parchments. Like, yeah, it's going to be a certain color and the light hit it. But he's like, no, it was
actual gold.
He was supernatural. So Philip K. Dick saw this in this vision. He claims when those jars were opened and the Nag Hammadi Gnostic codexes were revealed again to the world, this entity was let free. And this started to accelerate this the spread of this knowledge and this new eon of existence that had been started with Crowley.
Isn't Gnosticism a little bit unhinged? Doesn't it? Sort of, would that explain why we've got kind of the world that we have at the moment? Like if it's escaped, there's some entity that's come and it's like pushing these ideologies.
I don't know, but we're going to explore this even more when we come up after the break with the Montauk conspiracy. And I'm going to explain to you how one of the most insane stories of all time, the Montauk chair, Preston Nichols, time travel,
force fields,
the Philadelphia experiment, how all of this ties in with Aleister Crowley, with the star system of Sirius, and with this entity that has forced itself upon the world in this new eon of Horus. That's coming up after the break on Plus.
I honestly don't know how you're going to do that. I cannot in any way envisage how that has any connection whatsoever. So I am on the edge of my seat looking forward to that. We're also going to be talking about the recurrence of Bigfoot and UFO sightings in Pennsylvania. It seems like everything is cyclical and it's all coming back. We're also going to be talking about strange skeletal beings that have been harassing
Skeletoids
that have been harassing residents of Pennsylvania and other locations across the United States. And of course, we'll finish up with a conspiracy theory about Bigfoot technology, radio technology.
Is it real?
A nice way to put bookends on that particular episode.
In the Plus extension, I have a new sample to share with you. It goes something like this.
It's real. It's real.
Doesn't have the same ring to it.
MysteriousUniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. Get access to the big extensions we do every single Friday. You also get an entirely exclusive show that comes out on Tuesdays just for Plus members. You also get a higher bitrate feed, so a much higher quality MP3 file. Totally ad-free version of the show as well. And of course, sign up for MU Max to get access to our massive back catalogue, all there exclusive to members, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. $9 a month helps support your favorite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of the podcast. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the mysteries after the break. For everyone else, we'll see you next week.